Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
It's the Orange and Black Insider Bengals podcast. Better late than never, I suppose, for some of you joining us live. We're a couple minutes later than expected, but appreciate you all tuning in. If you are watching us live, or if you're catching us after the fact, we weren't late then. We're doing okay. I'm Anthony Cosenza, and I am joined by the birthday boy, John Sheeran. What are we celebrating? 21, John? Just kidding.
Let's go with that. Yeah. 25, I guess, if we have to be honest with ourselves.
How was it?
It was very nice. Me and my family went to the precinct, which, as a lot of you now know, is like the hotspot for attracting Bengals free agents. I've been there a lot in my life. It was actually my Steelers fan grandfather's favorite place to go for their anniversary. So I've been a frequent guest there. For the first time, though, last week, we sat in like the bar area, in like the back of the restaurant, and apparently in the booth next to us, my dad like had gotten up to go to the bathroom, and he came back to our table and said, "Hey, John, I think there's a Bengals player sitting next to us in the booth next to us." I'm like, "Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if they're like celebrating something." And then I thought to myself, me and Logan Wilson, we share the exact same birthday. Like, we were both born on July 8th, 1996. He turned 25 the same day I turned 25. I'm like, I wonder if Logan Wilson is here celebrating his birthday. So I asked my dad, "Hey, so what does this guy look like?" Well, he has a Bengals hat on, and he's white, and he's kind of like medium build. Like, oh my God, that's probably Logan Wilson. So I don't want to like get up and like disturb his meal or like make it obvious that I'm looking over to his table. So I just chill. We just have a nice, very nice dinner. Had the New York strip there, and I just wait for, I guess, their table to get up, and then I can get a look at him. And they finally get up after like an hour, and I see just the most average looking white dude who's like 5'10", maybe like 190 pounds, like the most scraggly beard possible. And I just slowly turn my head over to my dad. I'm like, "That is not Logan Wilson or anyone who's ever touched an NFL football field." But dinner was nice. Birthday was nice. And Logan Wilson, if you're out there listening, hope you had a happy 25th birthday as well.
Oh, that's a good story. I like that one. Logan is, I think he's represented by Carrick Sports, who they were kind enough to give us access to Marcus Bailey last year. And Logan Wilson, one of our guys that we think can potentially break out for the Bengals in his second year. We're going to end the show on one of our last segments with a breakout player. It won't be Logan Wilson. We'll spoil it that way for you, but maybe we'll do Logan Wilson down the road if we're so inclined. We're going to get to a breakout player. We're going to get to some headlines. And then, of course, we've got a lot more to talk about. We've got a positional preview as well. And an announcement, a little bit of one at the end of the show. I'm going to surprise my co-host maybe a little bit because we haven't had a chance to connect on it. But happy to have everyone with us. Happy belated birthday to John. Good to be back talking some Bengals. If it feels like we haven't been on for a while, but let's start the show. Why not start it this way? Let's start it with the haters. Ben Volin of what is it? Boston Globe, I believe. Mm-hmm. He puts out this article that basically, I don't know, arbitrarily ranks And this is a guy covering the New England Patriots. He's probably been to every single city, every single downtown, and spent a weekend or more there. So he is a guy who, I guess, feels that he's got the clout and or the experience to rank downtowns and city experiences and all of that. And wouldn't you know it, that Cincinnati and its downtown ranked dead last in Ben Volin's arbitrary list of best and worst NFL cities in the league. I will give him credit here, though, John. It's not like he put the New England experience like top five, top of the list, and went total homer with it. I think New England's and Foxborough was middle of the road. But let's start with the haters, man. What do you think about this?
Whenever there's a list like this, if you rank an entire group of things from best to worst, there's always going to be someone who gets hurt. And in this case, it just happens to be Cincinnati. If we can read his entire prompt describing the city, and I guess it's for the record, this was, I guess, describing the entire experience of traveling, spending a weekend in Cincinnati, not just the game day experience, but the tailgating, what to do in the city, and I guess also factoring in just the quality of games and the quality of the team itself. So he said, quote, "Cincinnati, the ribs at Montgomery Inn are great." True. "And you can stay across the river in Covington to cross Kentucky off your list of states to visit. But there's not much going on in downtown Cincinnati. The stadium has no tailgating space, and Bengals games are rarely exciting." Well, there are some hints of truth here. Montgomery Inn, fantastic. I believe who was on a couple months ago who loved Montgomery Inn? He played for the Dolphins. Yeah, exactly. So we all know Montgomery is great. Covington's actually very beautiful. It's very nice to stay there, and you have a great view of downtown Cincinnati. The skyline of Cincinnati is fantastic. I can't believe he left off Skyline Chili in this description. I guess he's never had it before. But there is one thing that I think Ben either hasn't been to Cincinnati in a while or just doesn't really know, but the differences in downtown Cincinnati compared to like 15 years ago, it's a whole new city, man. And I think that the Bengals benefit from just the growth of downtown and the banks and just the growth of commerce and industry, just between the two professional stadiums. Like, it's so much better than what it used to be. And I know that Ben has been in the game for a long time and he's been to many of these cities and has a good idea about what everything is and what it entails. But I think that Cincinnati does deserve more credit for that, for it being a more attractive city to visit, especially just for a weekend if you're going to a game. And like, but at the same time, like, he is right that tailgating space has dwindled significantly with the growth of the banks. Like, the parking lots are just not as spacious as they used to be. There's obviously more development where some of the old parking lots used to be. So compared to other massive stadiums like Dallas and Arizona, there's not a lot of places to park, set up your grill, and have a traditional tailgating experience. But I think that, you know, this doesn't do a great job of really describing how much that area has grown in terms of just being a modernized downtown area for people to hang out and chill and have a good time leading up to the game. And then lastly, Bengals games are really exciting. You kind of have to give them that one. They've had a winning season in 5 years.
I guess I can give them that one. And look, I can't pretend to, I can't pretend to, you know, say I'm a local because I don't live in Cincinnati. I visited a handful of times. I've had a great time every time I've been there. And yes, I channeled a little bit of a Sam Weish quote there. I don't live in Cincinnati. I guess a twist on one. But look, my mind went to a couple of different things. And by the way, we have a listener. I think it's here. It's John Wick. I got a bone to pick with John Wick. He put out a tweet about the best California Bengals fans, and I was not included in that tweet, John. What's the deal, man? What's the deal? Come on. Just kidding. We love you, John. But look, my mind went to a couple of different places with this. Number one, when I have been there and out there for games, and I think you can just sense this when you look at Twitter, you look at social media, all of it. The passion of Bengals fans really rivals, I think, any other fan base. And I think it can definitely be said that that is true, because a lot of us have stuck through a lot of bad years, like you just mentioned at the end of your statement there, John. And there's a lot of bad years, and we have stuck through them. We have remained passionate. And, you know, I mean, that says kind of a lot about the fan base itself. The other thing where my mind went after reading this was, I think it was it Seth Reese or Seth Tanner? I can't remember his
last
name.
Seth Tanner.
Seth Tanner, yes. Bengals, I think he's a media relations guy for them. Look, he said, you know, there's going to be this. This is going to be proven wrong because of something that's coming out this year. What the Bengals are going to be doing, what that is, we're not quite sure. But John, where I went with this is maybe he's got a point that Cincinnati in the past has not been, you know, the greatest tailgate slash weekend football experience. I don't agree with that, but maybe he's got some valid points there. But where I went with this was the Ring of Honor and what the Bengals are trying to do and our conversations about, you know, do you build a little wing at Paul Brown Stadium honoring some of these players, have some relics, some, you know, some players there that are hanging out and, you know, from yesteryear, and make that a kind of experience and a fan-driven experience, not only for Bengals fans, but for out of town fans that are maybe rooting for the away team. And you go into this little thing, if you are a true football fan, you go maybe into this wing, if that's what the Bengals plan to build, and you say, this is kind of a cool experience. I didn't know about this guy. I didn't know the Bengals had all these great players. Wow. And you get educated as a fan from another team, and you get kind of your a little bit more of a weekend experience. And maybe that all ties into the Ring of Honor. I don't know. Maybe I'm just spitfiring and talking nonsense, but that was a thought that I had about everything with this.
No, for sure. Shout out to Seth Tanner. He was hired on last year. I think he came originally from the Kansas City Chiefs. Obviously, they are well known for their game day experience and everything that's great about Kansas City and that area. He, like, their plan for enhancing the game day experience that was supposed to be last year, they couldn't really utilize it because of COVID and everything. But I do believe that everything about that just in stadium experience is going to be enhanced. And that's like, they need to do that, right? They need to take advantage of, you know, the passion that this fan base has and how much that stadium gets filled when the team is good. Like they need that, because honestly, the nature of this list, it's comparing 30 metropolitan areas of the country. When you compare just the biggest cities and the most vibrant cities and communities in the United States, Cincinnati does not come close in terms of population and just things to do compared to, you know, the big cities like New York and Chicago and even New Orleans, who I believe was number one on Ben's list. Like Cincinnati, they don't have that advantage, that market size to offer, you know, just the casual NFL fan a way to, like, hey, come travel to us, come see a Bengals game on the road, compared to other great cities in America. Like, they can't compete with Bourbon Street in New Orleans. They can't compete with the history of Lambeau Field in Green Bay. They can't compete with South Beach in Miami. So I think it's really up to Seth to make sure that that game day experience is phenomenal. And also, I think what's on Cincinnati's side and just inviting other opposing fan bases or just casual NFL fans trying to check off other stadiums and cities on their wish list, Cincinnati is a great place to just see a game and just interact with Bengals fans, because Bengals fans have been through a lot and they don't just, you know, alienate opposing fan bases because, you know, they don't wear orange and black. You know, they're very welcoming to other fan bases because they know the hardships. They know the hurt of suffering through losing seasons. And, you know, whenever you just hang out with them in bars or in tailgates and parking lots, whatever, it's very open. It's a great vibe. And that should also enhance the overall experience as well. So it's not going to get better unless Cincinnati becomes this metropolitan city that compares to other big cities in America, and like they also move next to a beach or something to compete with these other cities. But the better the game day experience is, and the better the team is, the sooner they'll rise up this list.
Well, and the thing is the more that these types of hit articles or hit pieces out there on the team, it seems as if finally over the past couple of years, likely spearheaded by Elizabeth Blackburn, the team is listening and they are making the strides necessary to do what they can to, you know, make a good fan experience at the games, into the off season, everything. As we've seen really over the past couple of seasons, like I mentioned, and the cool uniform unveiling that they did this year, all of the hype around the past two draft classes and whatnot, you know, they've really revved things up, and, you know, hopefully that begins to lead to these kind of hit pieces going away for the Cincinnati Bengals and or the city of Cincinnati. Again, we don't really want to give too much run to this because it is an arbitrary list, but it was something where you go, whoa, man, hey, take it easy a little bit. Take it easy there, Ben. Let's transition. I think you wrote this one up on Cincy Jungle. We don't have to talk too much about this, John, but I chatted about this on the water cooler chat yesterday. This one was just interesting to me because it actually had a positive spin in terms of the Bengals and where they fare in where some predict them to fare in 2021 and the rest of the AFC North. This is on cincyjungle.com. And here you go, man. I mean, you can tell us about this because you put this up here. But they've got the Bengals with a winning record, not making the playoffs even with an extra seed there, that seventh seed that's been added and the extra game. They've got them at 9-8. And the odd thing, man, I don't know how it's possible with these teams playing each other twice throughout the season, but they've got them one win apart, basically, you know, Ravens, the Browns, and Steelers, the Bengals. Ravens 12-5, Browns 11-6, Steelers 10-7, Bengals 9-8. Since you wrote this up, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this prediction here.
No, like, that's the whole crux of this. Like, I think this was a collective effort by CBS Sports and their different writers in predicting records for every single team. But I think in this overall process, they didn't ultimately come to a aggregate record of that would net out to 500, which is what happens every single year. So I don't think this is entirely accurate in terms of how it can actually unfold. But man, what would happen if the Bengals finished 9-8, finished above 500 for the first time in half a decade, and still finished last in the division? Like, what would that mean for Zach Taylor? Because that's honestly, like, I don't know if that's ever happened before. Like, it may have happened once or twice, but I can't think of one off the top of my head. And I guess if any division, if this is possible, especially in the AFC, I guess it has to be the North. Like, you have to think there is some regression coming for the Steelers and maybe even for the Ravens and Browns itself. But if the Bengals finish 9-8 and you're looking at this from the end of the year, they not only missed the playoffs, but they're in last place. What does that mean for Zach Taylor? What are the optics of either keeping him or firing him after that season?
That's a fantastic question. It kind of piggybacks. I'll try and pin it up here from one we got from our buddy Mike Holbrook on Facebook. Essentially, here it is right here. Essentially asking what record will coach have to keep his job this year. And that kind of ties into your comment here about, you know, Bengals are, to me, you go Bengals are 9-8. That's a pretty big leap forward from the past couple of years. They've got a winning record. You kind of feel good about the young core of players at that point. But like you said, if this really plays out this way, they're still cellar dwellers, right? So it's kind of like, I mean, is that really a badge of honor at that point? And what message then does that send, whether you keep or fire Zach Taylor, if this were to come to fruition? If you are you got a winning record, you don't make the playoffs, and you've shown that big leap of progress that Bengals fans have been wanting so badly over these past couple of years, and you see that with not a 9-win season, but you still can't keep up with the Joneses and the rest of the division. What does that tell the rest of your locker room? Hey, winning record, but last place, and we're not making any changes. This may be, John, if this were to play out something like this, where the Bengals have a winning record, but they are still last in the division, this may be where we see the little bit of a concession where Zach Taylor maybe keeps his job, but then you start seeing some of his assistants and whatnot being shown the door, and they will note, the Bengals would note progress. And I would say, you know, 9 wins from there is showing progress, but that is, you bring up a really interesting conundrum there with the Bengals having a winning record, showing progress, but being in last place in this scenario.
Yeah, and we have some comments saying, like, the Patriots went 11-5, missed the playoffs. The Browns went 10-6, 1 year, missed the playoffs. Like, that does happen, but it's very rare, at least in the 16-game format, for a team to finish above 500, not just at 500, above 500, and finish last, which obviously means they can't make the playoffs. There's not enough wildcard teams for that to actually happen. And I think if you do finish 9-8 and you're somehow third or fourth in your own division, probably means you didn't do well in your own division. Like, there's no way that you could have gone 500 or above in your six division games if your fellow division opponents have 12, 11, in 10 wins. And then I know that everyone thinks that the Steelers are going to progress, and that this is the chance for the Bengals to move out of fourth place to at least the third place. But this would be interesting. And I do think that this is more possible now with the 17-game schedule, with that extra division, with that extra game against an interconference opponent. Like, if they go 4-0 against the NFC, that definitely helps the AFC North in increasing the chances of, you know, three of them making the playoffs again, which I believe this does have that happening. They have the Chiefs at one, Bills at the 2 seed, Ravens, Titans, Browns, Colts, and Steelers, which, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't that the same exact seven teams that made the playoffs last year, which would be very unlikely in the NFL from a year-to-year standpoint?
Correct. And I mean, those are good teams, and they've done particularly Kansas City. You can even look at Tennessee in some respects with the Julio Jones trade, but particularly Kansas City doing a lot to fix their issues that we saw on center stage in the Super Bowl with the offensive line additions that they have made. But I mean, it is rare in this day and age in the NFL, because it is a league built on parity, and teams are doing what they can, and, you know, injuries hit different teams, and how they cope with all of that is all, you know, kind of different. But at any rate, interesting article there, as the Bengals maybe are picked by CBS Sports to be a little bit better than some other pundits picked them to be at this point in time for this year. And I guess it would be, I had kind of 9 wins as maybe a point that the Bengals could reach this year. I think a lot of things had to go right, and they had to mature fast and show progress. I guess I would feel more confident about that, obviously, if Joe Burrow was playing the rest of last year and you continued to see those steps. Maybe they won, you know, 6 games last year, and then they made the additions they made. But, you know, that's not the reality that we're dealing with at this point. I want to go here, John, and this is just a little bit of, we had a little mention of Bengal Jim here. So here's Bengal Jim on CincyJungle.com. This is from our fearless leader over there, Jason Markham. And this is kind of some training camp dates, I believe. And of course, a big announcement that they made, John. And this kind of ties into a little bit what we're talking about with the first story that we covered in the, what the Bengals are doing with the Ring of Honor and all of that. But they announced that they are going to be inviting fans back to Paul Brown Stadium for Back Together Saturday on July 31st. Fans can watch the practice, and there's family-friendly activities, inflatables, face painting, balloon artist pictures. I'm sure there's a adult beverage and non-adult beverage garden of some kind. They'll have all kinds of different things. And the big thing about this, John, is it just seems like a bit of normalcy after everything that we experienced all of last year into this year. And it seems as if they are going to be pretty safe about this, but just kind of feels nice that fans will be welcomed back. And I think they're, what are they letting in, upwards of 5,000, I think, to this event, I think I read. So pretty cool thing here, and it sounds like a fun event.
Yeah, like a lot of my memories growing up involve watching Bengals training camp, especially in the old days when they were down in Georgetown and they had those practices in like the Georgetown Stadium. So you always had a good view of the practices, and they also had other practice fields that you can go around. But, you know, they've had this family day type event during normal years ever since they moved back to Cincinnati for training camp. It's fun. You know, you can be in the shade if you're on the west side during the day. You always have a good view again of the practice field. Everything is on one field, so you don't have to worry about going over to another field or looking, you know, on the far side of the field. Like, everything is pretty much in front of you. So if you are considering going to training camp for the first time or going back after a year off from COVID, I would definitely recommend this. I guess it should be noted that in years past, you know, they've had upwards of like a dozen open practices to the public. This year, it's only 3, including this type of deal on July 31st. I think the other open practices are on Saturday, August 7th and Sunday, August 8th, which I believe I think that's actually on the practice field. So those are on just the traditional training camp practice fields where it has been for the past 10 or so years. But this seems like a lot of fun for people who want to get back into the swing of things. Maybe you've never seen a practice in person before. So definitely check this out if you're interested.
And I think the first preseason game, as we sit here on Wednesday, July 14th, I think we're just about a month out from the first preseason game, are we not, John?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So pretty good stuff and a fun event. And it's you can go. I put the link in all of the live chats there, bengals.com/camp. You can go check that out and sign up for your tickets. I have no idea how many are left available at this point in time, but go check that out. And if you are so inclined, and should be a good time and a little bit of steps towards normalcy. And like you said, they didn't open the floodgates completely in terms of the amount of practices and events that fans can attend, but they had a limited number, and this seems like a cool event. So wanted to share that in terms of the dates if folks had not heard. Anything else you want to get to before I let you take the lead in just a second on the positional preview?
Just real quick, Pro Football Reference, the just God site for NFL statistics, apparently have been doing this for like a decade. They've been compiling research over like from 1960 to 1981 of unofficial sack numbers. Now, the NFL did not recognize quarterback sacks as an official statistic until the 1982 season, but obviously there are plenty of Hall of Fame pass rushers who played in the 60s and 70s, and they obviously registered their quarterback sacks during those time periods, and that information has always been very tough to find. You had to go to, like, you know, wherever they did compile this stuff. It took a long time, but this week they posted these unofficial sack numbers on their website, and we got a lot of clarity on just how productive some of these former Bengals players in the 70s were. I know that Eddie Edwards is recognized as the official team leader on Bengals.com in terms of sacks with 83.5. On ProFootballReference.com, Eddie Edwards is credited with 84.5 sacks from 1977 to 1988. So those first, I believe that's 5 years of him in a Bengals uniform. That is now unofficially official, if you will, because it's still not considered an official statistic, but the numbers are there to be posted. And honestly, when doing some research on this and putting together like the official, unofficial top 10 career sack leaders and top 10 single season sack leaders, I learned a lot about Mike Reed, who I'd never heard of before in my life, which is why this Ring of Honor thing is such a big deal. Mike Reed played like 5 years and like as one of like the first Bengals rosters in like the early 70s. And he's, I think, sixth all time in sacks, in unofficial sacks with 49. So it's averaging 10 a year. And which is why, like, he's listed three times in the top 10 single season sack leader list. He had 13 sacks in 1973, 12 sacks in 1972, 1971. I believe he was a two-time Pro Bowler and an All-Pro. And he was like kind of on the smaller size. So he was like the Geno Atkins before Geno Atkins 40 years later, but just playing in a totally different era of football. So just seeing that, you know, posted for everyone to see and kind of learning about, you know, Edwards and obviously Coy Bacon's 21.5 sacks from 1976. That was really nice to see and really nice to learn about a Bengals former great that I never even knew before.
Yeah, he's also a country music artist, I guess. I that's something I learned a little bit about him too. And another name, you know, you got Gary Burley in there, another guy that is a name that old-time Bengals fans are familiar with as well, and a great guy. You know, it's really cool to see that. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, I still don't think the NFL has officially recognized those stats, more the Pro Football Reference, which is like one of the sites I geek out on the most, that they have done the legwork in compiling this. So hopefully this is one of those steps where then the NFL itself follows suit and says, hey, you know, these are statistics worth counting and worth accounting for in terms of NFL history. But yeah, Coy Bacon and Mike Reed and a lot of different players, you get to know those guys when stuff like this happens. So appreciate you bringing that up.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity, but giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else. and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Before we get to the position, I'll let my co-host tell you which position we're going to get to. We want to tell you about Symbull, S-I-M-B-U-L-L. You heard us talk about it before. It is the stock market for sports, John, as you know, and I hope our listeners know at this point. You can go to symbull.app/OBI, and I will put that link in all of the chats as well. And if you go there and you use the promo code OBI, you get a $10 sign-up bonus. What does that go to? Well, when you sign up for Symbull, you can invest your money in teams, and you can put that $10 bonus right in your account there and invest it in the team of your choice. Maybe it's the Bengals based on what you feel about them this year, or John, maybe the Reds, other teams out there. They don't just limit it to National Football League.
Absolutely. If you guys are watching the NBA Finals right now, the Bucks and the Suns, I think, are playing as we speak. Game 4, Suns have a 2-1 lead. Right now, the Bucks are priced at $41. The Suns are priced at $38. If you guys think that the potential winner of that series is about to start a dynasty in the NBA, all you have to do is just invest at the current price and then watch your earnings either grow or diminish based off of your knowledge of the sports. It's really just leveraging and weaponizing your knowledge of every MLB, NBA, NFL, and now starting July 1st, college football team, and just playing for the long run. You know, in college football, you have the four highest priced teams are Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, Oklahoma. Maybe the Bengals draft strategy is based off a Symbull. I don't know. We have a lot of players from those teams, but that's basically the crux of it. And just like Anthony said, if you want to get $10 off on your first deposit, go to www.simbull.app/OBI. Get that $10 off. Start investing.
It's a long play. You gotta do it. If you're doing fantasy football, if you're doing sports betting, if you play the stock market, you got to get in on Symbull. It's a fun way to make money and potentially make money on teams that you're passionate about. What's better than that? John, what position are we going with this week?
So we started this position group preview a few weeks ago. We started cornerbacks, then went to offense with tight ends, went back to defensive linebackers. Going back to offense now, we're going with a position of a lot of controversy, a lot of competition on the back end of the roster, quarterbacks. Not that much controversy here. It's the dead season. You know, we want to save some of those juicier positions for when things are actually happening. But, you know, it's quarterbacks. There's four of them on the roster right now. We all know one. His name is Joe Burrow. We all know his backup. His name is Brandon Allen. And then there's two other guys in Kyle Shurmur and Eric Dungy, who, I'll be honest, I know nothing about. I think he went to Syracuse, I want to say. Mm-hmm. Kyle Shurmur is the son of longtime NFL coach Pat Shurmur. I accidentally stood behind him in Paul Brown Stadium when I went to see the Bengals jerseys. I believe he was just doing some rehabilitation in the stadium. He's a tall guy at 6'4". Anthony, like, there's not that much to talk about, which is why we kind of saved it for this episode right before training camp starts. But it's really just, like, I don't know. Like, just how bad does Brandon Allen have to screw up, I guess? Like, they invested a year in him for this year, just a one-year deal for his contract. And then Shurmur and Dungy are just here to take the reps. And aside from that, I guess, I mean, we've talked about Burrow ad nauseum, every single angle of his recovery, his potential in year two breakout. In terms of just the overall positional structure, though, is there any possibility that with Burrow's ongoing recovery that there is a chance that either Shurmur or Dungy even sneak the week one roster?
So we can start with that one. Maybe we talk a little Burrow to end the preview, the positional preview here, just to see maybe outlook and what expectations and whatnot. But I guess where I would go with this, John, would be comfortability level with Brandon Allen based on what we saw last year. And the other two quote unquote, pushing him for a backup spot. Is there a veteran option out there that the Bengals may be waiting in the weeds for to pounce on? And maybe there's someone out there. We've seen them make moves. Now, this was under Marvin Lewis, but we've seen them make moves for players that in quarterbacks after last cuts. Who was the one kid from Central Michigan a few years ago? His name escapes me. They bounced him on and off the roster. There was a kid from Oklahoma State that they grabbed from the Lions, I think. So after final cuts, now this was, again, probably 5+ years ago. I got to go back, but those are just kind of some top of the head type of scenarios that have popped up. I liked a lot of things that I saw from Brandon Allen. He actually surprised me in a pleasant way at times last year. I just don't know how, if he's the only guy on the roster, I don't know how to gauge my comfort level with that behind Joe Burrow. And they may only go two quarterbacks based on who they currently have. And if Joe Burrow is proving to be on track with rehab, going to start and fully healthy, all of that, they may go light at quarterback to go heavy at some of these other crowded position groups we've talked about, wide receiver, linebacker, whatnot. I don't know. But it's really, to me, the main question, aside from Joe Burrow's health, his rehab, how all of that's going, it's how confident are we in Brandon Allen should he need to step in, whether it's in week one and get that spot start, or if, God forbid, we're going down the same road that we did at the end of last year.
Well, just imagine asking this question 11 months ago, which is when Brandon Allen joined the team. Mm-hmm. At the time, you had Joe Burrow with two perfectly fine knees. You had Ryan Finley entering his second year, a former fourth-round pick, and you had Jake Dolagala, I believe, still on the roster, who, you know, surprised people with his 2019 training camp, and people expected him to compete with Ryan Finley for that backup job. And then 4 weeks after Brandon Allen gets signed, he's on the roster. He's more than just a COVID backup, if you will. He's the guy who's actually pushing Ryan Finley for potential snaps. And then when the chips were down and Burrow's on the stretcher, Finley came in, he stunk it up, and then they immediately went to Brandon Allen. No one expected anything from Brandon Allen, who was just a career backup. He had a couple starts here and there with the Broncos, but never really did anything to establish himself. He was available in late July of 2020 for a reason. And then he surprisingly was decently effective behind a terrible offensive line and a limited receiving core in terms of explosion and athleticism. So now you're looking at Brandon Allen and it's like, oh yeah, he's like one of the top backup quarterbacks in the NFL based off what he did last year. And there is comfortability with him potentially just carrying or just monitoring an offense, being like the point guard facilitator, if you will. That was what we tried to explain was Andy Dalton for the last couple of years of his career here. So the perception of Brandon Allen has changed dramatically over a year. And I just think that's like the nature of how marginal some of these backup quarterbacks are and how crazy their trajectories can become based off of just situation and opportunity. Because if Brandon Allen, you know, if Joe Burrow never gets hurt and Brandon Allen never sees the field, like, you're not thinking of Brandon Allen any different than you thought of him last year when they just brought him in because he happened to know Zach Taylor because there was a connection with, you know, the early parts of his career.
I don't want to go down the road of no Joe Burrow, because that's just a depressing road to go down. But I will say this, that when Brandon Allen was in last year, he did not have, at certain points, specific offensive lineman. He did not have a Riley Reiff. He did not have Joe Mixon in there. He did not have a Jamar Chase in there. He did not have a revamped T. Higgins. T. Higgins was playing well for him, but he did not have the T. Higgins we have seen this offseason, at least. So if it does come down to Brandon Allen needing to get a spot start, needing to come in for some playing time for whatever reason, you know, I guess I would be a little bit more confident based on the fact that the Bengals have done a little bit at some of their weaker areas and or replenished some talent, maybe got healthier at some critical spots with critical players. So I would feel a little bit more comfortable that way.
And I guess if we have to talk about Burrow, or if we have to talk about something new with Burrow, because we've, again, overanalyzed everything with his recovery and projecting him this year, I guess we can kind of talk about just what to expect in the next few weeks. You know, training camp is starting in a couple weeks now for all intents and purposes, we're operating under the assumption that Burrow is not going to really have any limitations, but that doesn't mean to have him do everything that he would normally do if there wasn't an injury in play here. I you know, based off what he said in May and June during OTAs, he was like 85% of the way there. And, you know, projecting that into August and September, that meant that he was going to be 100% by the time the chips are down and things are going for real. But I guess it's like, even if Burrow can do basically 95% of everything in training camp and preseason, how much do you want him to do? Or are you comfortable with, you know, creating these simulated scenarios where he's facing even the slightest bit of pressure? Because, like, he may not see a snap in the preseason, and I think everyone would be fine with that, but to just throw him in again into just the regular season without any, you know, real live action reps, it's going to be something interesting to monitor.
I agree with you, and you don't want to rush him in if he's not ready. But I think if what happened last year didn't happen, not only the no preseason games, but the shortened season because of his injury, I think you got to give him something. If he's able to get out there, I think you got to give him something. And I don't think in a preseason game, yeah, you may have some young and hungry guys out there trying to get a roster spot, and, you know, maybe there's some pressure or whatnot. But you know, I would like to see if he is ready to go. I would like to see maybe just a little bit of time so he gets a little bit of that rust off. It has been since what, early November, right? Since he played a meaningful snap in a game. And I don't know, I would like to see something, but again, I do not want to risk the merchandise, as Jay Gruden would say, don't touch the merchandise. So I get the mindset either way. My guess is they probably won't play him in preseason. They don't even want to risk that, but there are risks with that just from a rust perspective. So I don't know. Expectations for Burrow from you this year, I think we all know he's coming in with a chip on his shoulder. I think we all think he's going to come in and play well, but just how well? Are we talking do you think we're talking comeback player of the year, MVP? Do you think we're kind of saying, hey, you know, still that top 10-ish type of performance because he is coming back from that injury? I mean, what are your expectations for him this year as he comes back from this injury?
If he's not at all bothered or hindered on the way for this comeback, there's no reason why he can't produce like an above average quarterback, reaching that top 10 status and whatever meaningful metric that you want to throw out there. Like it's all there. Like the offensive line is good enough. The receiving core is by far top 10, top five in the league. You have an entire scheme that's now a year and a half in the making that's built around him and what he does well. Like, I know there's still questions of Zach Taylor and just his ability to manage a game and to, you know, lead a productive offense, but that productive offense usually comes from the quarterback. Like, he's the most important person on the team and in operations. And when he's this good, there's no reason why it shouldn't be as good as you want it to be with everything that, with everything else that's around him. So like expectations wise, you know, it's hard to just throw numbers out there, but like the Bengals passing career passing yardage record for a season was set by Andy Dalton as like 4,300 yards. Like if Joe Burrow plays 17 games with Ja'Marr Chase, Tyler Boyd, T. Higgins, there's no reason why he shouldn't eclipse 4,000 yards and be in contention of the record or potentially break it. Like we could look back 6-7 years from now and think 4,400 yards for Joe Burrow, that's a light day. Like that's the expectation when you have a good quarterback in the year 2021 in the NFL. Like 4,000 yards is nothing. It happens to just average quarterbacks now. And it rarely happened for Bengals quarterbacks in recent years after Carson Palmer. But as soon as the game evolved to the point now where passing is king and teams are throwing the ball 600 times a year, like that's the expectation. You have the quarterback. You have the receivers. As long as the quarterback is healthy and he has enough time and he can throw the ball consistently under 3 seconds, there's no reason why he shouldn't have one of the most productive quarterback seasons in recent Bengals history.
Yeah, 9.5 games, 10 if you want to call it that, he averaged basically 269 yards passing per game, did Joe Burrow. And I think, gosh, what was it at the beginning of the year here? It was 1, 2, 3, I mean, there's three 300-yard passing games in a row in weeks 2 through 4. And then he had another one in week 6 against Indianapolis, a 400-yarder against Cleveland. So, I mean, he was dealing towards the beginning, middle of that season. And, you know, there's no, aside from maybe a rehab hiccup, there's no real reason to believe that he can't produce the same, and if not better. He, too, by the way, as we know, he too has been going through a rigorous workout regimen, not only to rehab that knee, but also upper body, building some strength and trying to work on that deep ball. He's now got the big time receiver that he's got the rapport with from LSU and Ja'Marr Chase. T. Higgins looks like a monster. So, yeah, I mean, let's go.
And I know there's still going to be people who are questioning the offensive line. We have freaking William Perry, shout out to the fridge, questioning it like the O-line does have stuff to prove. That's true. But you just heard Anthony, right? He was still productive behind that terrible offensive line. And in terms of just individual expectations, he can still produce behind an offensive line that doesn't have to be above average or even average. Like, if the offensive line just barely improves, he can still throw for a lot of yards. And his touchdown interception ratio was still 13-5. He was still pretty productive for a rookie playing with very non-explosive weapons. And in terms of like being comeback player of the year, I guess that does have to do with being successful and being in the limelight and being in playoff contention. So that is obviously remains to be seen. But in terms of just him just progressing in that year two jump that most great quarterbacks take, there's no reason why this Bengals team right now can't provide that for him.
Yeah, the one caveat, too, and I don't know if you agree with me or not, but the one caveat, too, is Joe Mixon and their commitment to the run game and where that's going to fall into place. Obviously, the Bengals want to get the run game going. They probably will be a pass-first team or a pass-often team. But, I mean, they are committed. They paid Joe Mixon that big contract. They brought back Frank Pollock, and they gave him a designation as a run game coordinator. So they are going to try to do something to get the run game going, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's going to eat into a lot of Joe Burrow's stats and whatnot. As it goes with Shurmur, Allen, and Dungy, really it's kind of just what do they do in the preseason? Do they do enough in the game scenarios to raise enough eyebrows, gain enough interest? And it's kind of the Jake Dolagala thing, right? I mean, are you promising enough to either keep you on the practice squad and develop you that way, or are you going to kind of falter when it comes to playing B, C, D squad guys in the preseason?
That's the beauty of being a quarterback. Like, there's just not a lot of you. There's only 32 starting jobs. There's typically only 32 backup jobs. So odds are every single team is going to carry a quarterback on their practice squad. And because they brought back the same practice squad rules from last year, there's going to be 16 spots available. So definitely one is going to be there for either Shurmur or Dungy. I think Shurmur, I guess, right now has the imaginary lead because I guess he's just more experienced and he has the NFL brain and heritage behind him. But it really just come down to who takes the most of their opportunities, because they're going to get plenty if Burrow's not going to be out there in the preseason, and if they're even still limiting him to some degree during training camp, they're going to get plenty of reps with the second and third team. It's just a matter of who does the best with them.
Well, that's, unless you got anything else, John, that is this week's positional preview, which it has been the quarterbacks, not much of a competition. We know Joe Burrow is the guy, obviously, that goes, I don't even know why I said that out loud, but he's the guy, and there is a scrum for jobs behind him. We'll see how it all plays out, but obviously the big thing we're all watching is Joe Burrow's rehab, which seems to be headed in an extremely, extremely good direction from what we've seen so far in spring and summer. So that is this week's positional preview. It has been the quarterbacks. We're going to continue on as the weeks progress with different position groups. So definitely want to be in tune for that. Another thing, and I'm letting John do all the work this week, by the way. Another segment we are starting is one we have done on this program quite a bit over the past couple of years, and that is breakout players. It's kind of a tradition now that training camp is coming out, coming towards us here in just a couple of weeks. So we like to introduce breakout players. Now, what breakout means is kind of subjective to the person. It could be someone that ends up carving out a nice role-playing role after being a fringe roster make, or it's a guy who takes the next step after being kind of a rotational guy, maybe is more of a starter, gets more snaps, that sort of thing. So obviously it just kind of depends. Maybe it's a guy that goes to a starter, to a Pro Bowler, just depends. But we kind of make up our own rules with it. John, who you got for your breakout player this week?
Right. So as Anthony mentioned, it could be a young player. It could be one entering like the last year of his rookie deal. It could be someone who is stepping into a bigger role or is primed for a bigger role based off how they played last year. Rarely, though, at least in my years of doing this podcast, has it been a free agent signing that the team made for him to be a starter. Like, usually those guys are pretty established in the league and they have established roles and they have established identities with, you know, like the fan base, and people have reasonable expectations for them. But for this week, I wanted to kick off with Larry Ogunjobi, because I just think that defensive tackle is a position that has been getting a lot of buzz with this team. There's apparently still, you know, reports or rumors about them potentially adding another player to the position group, even though they have like 9 or 10 of these guys right now on the roster right now. But it was an emphasis this offseason. Like, depth killed them at the position last year. They ran through a ton of bodies that they had to sign during the season because they kept getting injured and they kept getting ran all over every single week, and they couldn't generate a pass rush to save their life because Geno Atkins was playing with a bad shoulder, all of that. So their biggest solution to this problem was Larry Ogunjobi, who played his first 4 years with the Cleveland Browns. He was, I believe, a third-round pick in the 2017 draft. And I remember that draft, like, thinking, like, this was still, like, you know, Geno Atkins was only, like, 30 or 29 at the time, but it was still a point in his career where I'm thinking they need to find a contingency plan for this guy. They need to find a potential successor because he's not going to stay elite forever. And that was one of the biggest issues with, you know, the late Marvin Lewis years. They could not draft defensive tackles to save their lives. They couldn't find any complimentary pass rushing help for Geno Atkins. And Larry Ogunjobi would have been a great solution for that. But the Browns picked him up. They snagged him. And he started for 3 years for Cleveland. Played various defensive tackle alignments and techniques for the Browns, but he ended his career specifically at nose tackle. So he didn't have a lot of chances to really rush the passer towards the later part of his career with the Browns. But as a player coming out of Charlotte, you know, small school, didn't have a lot of buzz during his college days, he was incredibly productive and he was incredibly athletic. I believe if you look at the mock draftable percentiles, he was 96th percentile in broad jump, 80th in terms of vertical jump. He ran like a 4.97 40-yard dash at 305 pounds. Like, the dude was an athletic ball of clay who was, again, productive at a very small school. So there was a lot of potential with him coming out of college. And obviously, you play 4 years in the NFL and you get a one-year deal worth about $6 million. You know, obviously, things didn't work out exactly as he planned in Cleveland. Otherwise, they probably would have brought him back. But I think this is a great opportunity now, surrounded by quality starters on the defensive line. You have Trey Hendrickson, Sam Hubbard, playing next to DJ Reader on the defensive line. He's going back to his natural position at the three technique spot. He's going to have a chance to just shoot up field, be a one gap penetrator, take advantage of that explosion and that speed at his size, and also playing another year in a contract year. Like, he's getting paid pretty handsomely for a 1 year deal, but there is definitely potential for him to be something more. He's still 27, 28 years old, I believe. And there's still, I think, a lot of good football ahead of Larry Ogunjobi, who's a quality technician along with being athletic as hell. In terms of just being a poetic successor to Geno Atkins, you know, Geno took him under his wing as soon as he got into the NFL. He always trained with him in the offseason. He's basically his best friend. And it's really cool to see in the first year that the Bengals moved on from Geno to basically give the reins at this position to one of his closest friends, a younger version of him, only, you know, not nearly as productive or as successful, but the potential is there. The athleticism is there. It wasn't best shown in the later part of his Cleveland career because he was just used a little bit differently, but there is a clear direction with how they're going to use him now, and they need all the pass rushing help they can get, and they're going to give him every opportunity to do so. So if any of these free agents are coming in and playing better than they did before, I have a lot of confidence that Larry Ogunjobi is going to be the best one.
Every time I watch the Cleveland Browns, namely against the Bengals, and the Bengals have the football, at least over the past couple of years, I always note that Larry Ogunjobi just seems to be around the football a lot. And he just seems to be an active defensive lineman. And you look at the statistics, John, You know, obviously rookie, still kind of finding his way, 32 total tackles and one sack. You look at 2018 and 2019, he had two pretty solid years from a guy that was a movable piece and an interior lineman there. I mean, you look at 2018, 52 total tackles, 5.5 sacks, and then follows that up in 2019, 50 total tackles, 5.5 sacks in 2019. Those totals dip a little bit, 46 total tackles last year, 2.5 sacks. So maybe that's where they said, you know, we saw maybe a slight regression last year. We're going a little bit of a different direction, and they reinvested in some different players. So he didn't get a ton of activity on the open market, but the Bengals were wise to pounce on this guy, just an active football player. And I think this all plays into what Lou Anarumo, Zach Taylor, and all of those guys want to do up front that we have talked about it ad nauseum, where they want to have guys they can move around. They want to have guys they can rotate in. We talked about Trey Hendrickson as a guy that they want to even kick inside at times. And this is one of those guys that they just want to rotate in and out. And I think he's going to be a heavy, heavy role player on this defense, but they're going to move things around. And I think if he can do what he did in 2018 and 2019, and if the Bengals can remain a lot more healthy on the defensive line this year, him included, I think you're going to see a big boost on the defensive side of the ball. And I think he would be a pretty good reason as to why that is.
And if that does happen, like you talk about rotation and moving guys around in different spots, like I don't see Ogunjobi really moving off of that position, which I think would definitely benefit him. I think the less that he moves around, the better, the more he can focus on just being that guy as a pass rusher. And again, still explosive as hell. He can hold his own in the run game against some of these down blocks. But if he does have this type of season where he does prove his worth on this 1 year deal, I think he is also a guy that they would absolutely consider bringing back, because it's more than just being productive on the field. Like a lot of the times, you know, in years past, the Bengals brought in some of these aging veterans who were on the downside of their careers, and they provided value because they were productive in their past, or they were a seldom known name. And so they were, you know, cheap to bring in. They were inexpensive, but they didn't really have any aspirations of, you know, making a long-term investment in them. I think with Ogunjobi, because he's still in his mid-20s, because he's still talented, and because I think Gino probably has told them a lot about who he is as a person and how much they've gotten to know him in the months that he's been in the building, I think he's absolutely a guy that they would be interested in retaining for the long term. Because if they don't, that's going to be somewhat of an issue, I guess, going into 2022. Like, who replaces Ogunjobi now as that pass rushing defensive tackle? You have basically no one else who can really slide into three technique. You have a bunch of nose tackles, including Reader and Tyler Shelvin, but you don't really have an explosive pass rushing presence who can play that position full time. So it's not only important for Ogunjobi to succeed and really up his worth and his value before he enters free agency next year, it's important for the Bengals to really get the most out of him and see if this is a guy that they truly do want to invest in long-term, because he's still going to be, I think, 28, 29 in a year from now. So there's no reason why they can't add on a couple years to his next deal.
Just a 53 PFF, overall PFF score last year for Ogunjobi. Why do you think the market wasn't, you know, you mentioned a lot of things, and rightfully so, that point to a guy who may still be an ascending player. I mentioned some of the stats from just a couple of seasons ago that were, you know, that point to a pretty solid defensive player. Why do you think the market was kind of a little bit cooler on him, and or why the Bengals were able to get a somewhat team-friendly one-year kind of rental deal out of a guy like this?
So it was the market was somewhat saturated at the position. You had guys like J.J. Watt, Dalvin Tomlinson, Shelby Harris, Michael Brockers, Roy Robertson Harris, who we talked about a little bit. Like, all those guys got more expensive deals than Larry Ogunjobi. But there, I remember some people being surprised that the Bengals gave him that much money. Like, they gave him like a $4.5 million signing bonus to add on to like his $1.5 million salary. Some people thought for as long as Ogunjobi stayed on the market, they could have even gotten him for cheaper. But that's just kind of how it was with the defensive tackle market. You know, it started off kind of hot. I think the Patriots made a couple of moves, including Devon Gaucho, who came from the Dolphins. So, like, that was just where the market was established. And then the Bengals kind of just got under that based off of just where the average was. And even still, like after they signed Ogunjobi, they were in the running for Sheldon Rankins, who then signed for like $5.5 million a year with the New York Jets. Malcolm Brown signed for like the same amount with the Jaguars. Jerron Reed went to the Chiefs for $5.5 million. That's just kind of where that market line was for the position, and there was just a lot of guys there who were on the open market, and then Ogunjobi, I guess, kind of had to wait a little bit longer than some of these other guys.
Yeah, Rankins was another guy that I know the Bengals were big on. I think they were even big on him back when he was drafted. But look, the Bengals want to improve their pass rush. They need to improve their pass rush. They need to force more big plays on defense, whether it's corralling interceptions that hit players' hands from the secondary and or linebackers, whether it's causing more errant passes because of a solid pass rush. I mean, they need big plays from their defense. They need turnovers. They need to create some short fields for Joe Burrow and the offense to really kind of capture leads and maybe start running away with games, not lose these one possession games that we've seen them lose so many times over the past handful of years, despite who was under center. And the Bengals made a concerted effort to try and boost their pass rush with a number of players. And this is a guy that should be able to give them at least a little something from the interior.
And if he does, there's more money to be made next year. They have a lot of it.
Yep. Yep. Well, good stuff. That is our first potential breakout player of 2021. Larry Ogunjobi, a free agent, has been a pretty solid player, a little bit of a dip in production last year, but a guy that should come in and contribute pretty well on the Bengals defense. That's going to wrap up most of the show tonight, but it's time for us to drop the mic and get on out of here. John, I'll let you go first, birthday boy. What you got for us?
Nothing much, man. It's mid-July, and I'm tired of this offseason. I'm tired of the dead season. I feel like this has been some of the longest 4 months of my life ever since the draft ended, or if that's even is 4 months, I think it might only be three. Feels like 4 years. I'm just ready for training camp next week. I think we have like one more show before it actually starts, but I don't know, man. I'm just like, I like the break. I like the downtime to an extent, but it just kind of hit me this week. You know, like I'm just ready to be more busy. I'm ready to be more active. I'm ready to talk about things that might actually start to matter.
Yep. And well, I think we're all in that same boat, man. We're especially just because of, We're feeling this momentum from this team and the young talent and the core of players that they have. So I think we're all in the same boat there. I'm going to start off with a little bit of an announcement. We've kind of gone here. It goes really well with our background there. we've talked about this charity fest thing. I don't even know if that's the official name we're calling it, but we're getting this going. We do have some prizes already lined up. We do have some things lined up. We're going to be doing this in the next couple of weeks. And we did start hearing back from some folks. I won't say who yet in terms of special appearances and whatnot, but I will say this, that they are associated with a couple of big names within the Ring of Honor that the Bengals are unveiling this year and some foundations. So what we need, though, from all of you, and we're going to get you the logistics and the details and all that kind of stuff, but what we need from you all is support. And we need, if we're going to, you know, commit to helping out some of these great charities that these current and former Bengals players are spearheading, you know, they need financial support. They need your donations, and your donations will go to a myriad of different Bengals players charities, and we've got prizes lined up for donors and all kinds of different swag and stuff like that. And then of course we're going to be hearing from some of these fine folks, current and former Bengal players and whatnot, that will be telling us about the foundations they run, telling them about their careers and all kinds of different things. So we've got a couple of commitments to that in terms of appearances. We've got some prizes and stuff, so we're looking forward to running with that. And maybe this will be a little bit of an ongoing thing over the next handful of weeks. So we really want to make a significant impact to a number of different charities. So John, I'm pretty excited about that, and you and I will continue planning that.
Absolutely, man. And I'm excited that we're getting stuff starting to roll on this, and I'm excited for all of our listeners out there. You know, there's a lot of passion, there's a lot of excitement, and you know, we want to use that excitement to highlight, you know, people that need it, you know, and just maybe foundations and organizations that you may have never even heard of before. And so this is a great opportunity. It's a great time of year to really just engage everybody and put, you know, these organizations and these charities in the spotlight right as things start to kick off. You know, it should be a great time when we do have it. And I can't wait for all the support from you guys, because you guys, it's going to be really important. And you guys being there for us and being there to support these organizations, these charities, it's going to be a lot of fun.
I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and something that's a little bit different, not only for us, but just doing a little something different, and hopefully it makes the impact that we want it to. One last thing. I don't know how public he wants this to be, but if you are on Twitter, Bengals fan, his name is Ryan Yunt. He's a former NFL Network producer. He is a Bengals fan, and he and I follow each other. I'm sure he follows you, John. But if you do not follow him, he did something that I have to go under the knife for surgery tomorrow on my arm injury, and I've been kind of fretting about that and freaking out about it a little bit, because it's never done that before, and mine's a minor thing. And I go and I find this on Twitter where Ryan ended up donating his kidney to his brother to save his brother's life. And I just, that just struck me as like, wow, man, here I am fretting about this thing, and you did this thing to your personal sacrifice to say, basically save your brother's life. At least that is the vibe of the story that I caught there. So if you can, I don't even know if he listens to the show. I know he followed me, and I'm sure he follows you. I don't know if he listens to the show, but Ryan, get well. That's a really, really awesome thing that you did. And, you know, Bengals Nation's behind you. Just heal up, man. John, I don't know if you caught that story, but I saw that and I was like, whoa, that's pretty awesome.
I did not, but like kidney failure and kidney issues, they're no joke. And like that's incredible to hear. So cheers to you, Ryan, man.
Yeah, big deal. Big deal. And on that note, folks, enjoy the rest of your week. Thanks for those who tuned in live. Thanks for those who listen after the fact. By the way, I didn't even say this tonight, but go get the show how you can. iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, all of the major audio platforms. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Make sure you also turn on notifications, not only when you subscribe to the podcast channel, but also our YouTube channel, so you can get notified when new material is out, when we go live, all of that, so you can join us. But hey, John, have a good week, bud. Happy belated birthday.
Thanks, man.
Take it easy, everybody.